Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'll be talking about your unconscious. Your unconscious and my unconscious. Our unconscious. And the way that our unconscious protects us from doing things that would not be in our best interest, even when we don't know that they are not in our best interest. I'll also be playing the second half, or maybe it's the second two-thirds, of my interview with jazz drummer and jazz educator Henry Ettman. And that'll be coming up right now. Welcome to The Lynn Show. If this is the first time you're listening, welcome, welcome. I'm really glad you're here. If you have listened before and you're back, I'm even more glad that you're here. If you have listened before, then you know some of the things I'm about to say. Please indulge me for the sake of those people who have not listened before. I'm a psychotherapist. I've been in practice a very long time. And as a result of that practice, I have written a book called When You Can, You Will. The book is about why we human beings cannot always do what we want to do when we want to do it. And I usually spend much of the first half of the show going through the book, describing those things that get between us and what we want to do. And the second half of the show is usually an interview, and most often part of a series of interviews that I'm doing called Anatomy of an Artist, in which I am interviewing people who make their living in one art form or another. And last week, I aired the first part of an interview that I did with Henry Ettman, who is a jazz drummer and jazz educator. And today I'm going to play the rest of that interview. And I think that I forgot to say last week that in a previous show, I think 2 weeks prior, I played an interview that I did with Henry's wife, Carol, who's a wonderful jazz singer. And today I'm going to play two cuts from Henry's CD, and one of them's going to feature Carol as the vocalist. Before I get to the book part of the show, I want to remind you, if you've been listening, and alert you if you haven't, that I'm doing an opinion poll to decide what songs I should use to start and end the show. What I've been doing since the beginning is, as you just heard, the song You Really Can opens the show, and the song I Won't Go With a Whimper closes the show, and both of these are on my CD. And I've been asking people to vote and to help me decide whether to keep that or switch them, and also to listen to the other songs on the CD and see if somebody thinks I should be using another song from the CD. And as it was suggested to me, I am playing all the songs on the CD this month. Last week I played two songs, and today I'm going to play two songs. If you are of a mind to vote, and I certainly hope that you are, please go up on my website, thelynshow.com, thelynneshow.com, click on Contact Me, and then tell me what you think. And now, before I get to the book section of the show, I'm going to play a song called Which Way Is Out.
I went to see the doctor. He lay me on his couch. And as I talked dreams, he put my money in his pouch. Whoa, whoa, which way? Which way is out into the sunshine or out into the rain? You know that I don't care who else is there, long as they don't claim to be sane. I went to see the guru. He sat me on the floor. And now my body just won't do the things it did before. Whoa, whoa, which way is out? Which way is out into the sunshine or out into the rain? You know that I don't care who else is there, long as they don't claim to be sane. Mama smiled, said all the while, there's nothing wrong with you. Whoa, whoa, would that were true? Please show me out into the sunshine or out into the rain, 'cause I don't care.
The information I'm going to talk about today comes from chapter 5 of the book, and that chapter is called Your Unconscious, A Friend in Need. This may run counter to a lot of the stuff that you have heard about the unconscious or think about the unconscious, or maybe you're unconscious about the unconscious and you don't think about it at all. But this is what I believe. And as you may have heard me say, if you've been listening to the show for a while, what you hear me say is always the gospel according to Lynn. It's not the truth with a capital T. What I talk about in these shows are things that I have had reason to believe in as a result of having observed in my 30 years of private practice and my many more years of living that these things are accurate, true, verifiable. But what I have is at best anecdotal evidence. And so if you find yourself having questions about this or not agreeing with me or not believing me, that is perfectly okay. And if you'd like to email me and tell me that you think I'm wrong, I'm fine about that. You can just go up on my website, thelynshow.com, thelynneshow.com, click on Contact Me and tell me whatever it is you want to say about what I have said. But what you're going to hear today is what I believe about the unconscious and how it acts in our lives. The shows to date have all been talking about the obstacles to change that we encounter when we want to do something or stop doing something that we cannot do or stop doing. I talked about the power of our family of origin. I talked about the need to create and maintain a cover story to protect undercover qualities. I talked about the dangers that loom when we're trying to do something that we are unable to do. Past dangers, future dangers, catastrophic expectations, and the danger of feeling. All of which I have talked about at length in the shows leading to today, and which you, if you didn't get to hear any of them, please go up on my website and see if they're up there yet and click on them and listen to them if you want to. But today I'm going to talk about an ally that you have, that we all have, actually, an advocate, a silent partner that protects us from danger. And that ally is our unconscious mind. Now, actually, we have two minds. We have a conscious mind and we have an unconscious mind. And both of our minds, the conscious and the unconscious, they provide us with ideas and skills and facts and memories and solutions to problems, but they operate very, very differently in our lives. You're almost certainly aware of your conscious mind, familiar with it, because it communicates with you through thought and awareness. That is, when you're thinking or making plans, you're using your conscious mind. It's the conscious mind that we most often think of as me. You may not be familiar with your unconscious mind or have any idea how it operates in your life, because your unconscious mind uses behavior to communicate with you. When you say or do something you don't understand or that you can't explain or that you wouldn't have predicted, you're probably using your unconscious mind. When you're using your unconscious mind, many of us think things like, well, that wasn't me talking, or I wasn't myself, or I didn't recognize myself. When your unconscious mind participates in your life, you may feel somehow that you're out of control. Even if you're familiar with your unconscious mind, you may not think of it as an ally. You may think of it as anything from an annoying kibitzer to a dangerous intruder. It can be difficult for people raised in our goal-oriented society to appreciate a part of themselves that seems to be stopping them from reaching their goals. Remember, we live in a control-freak society. You would not be uncommon if you were interested in control. And because the unconscious mind often seems to be making us do things that we didn't want to do, and we can't understand the greater reason for it, or at least our conscious mind can't understand that, we may feel like we're out of control, and that can feel very, very scary to a lot of people. But I believe that the very behavior for which the unconscious mind is most often condemned, that is, blocking the path to change, that's the very behavior for which it should be applauded. And in the coming weeks, I will talk about the many, many ways in which our unconscious mind participates in our lives, the many ways in which it protects us from doing things which we want to do, but for which we are unaware that there will be a price to pay if we do it prematurely. I'll be explaining the ways that the unconscious mind stops us and how you can recognize that action taking place in your life, how you can see the hand of your unconscious as it is protecting you. But now I'm going to play another song from my CD. This will be the second song. And if you think that either one of these songs should open or close my show, or the songs that do it now should continue to do it, or they should be reversed, please go up on my website and vote. But here is a song called Worth the Price.
Some say that we are born alone, and that is how we'll die. And I have known life's loneliness to sneak up like a spider. Oh, and when we two are wrapped up tight, there is no hers, no his, 'cause I am you and you are me, and we are all there is. And a life devoid of passion but never will suffice, so I will go the distance, because love, it's worth the price. Others say we're not alone, we're one big entity. Yes, we're all linked together, swimming in a cosmic sea. Oh, and I want to believe it, but I only think it's true when I'm holding on for dear life. So I will go the distance, because love, it's worth the price. It's worth the price for the pleasure. It is worth the price of the pain, for the feeling that I'd rather die than not have you again. Pay admission to enter paradise. So I will go the distance, because you're worth the price.
And now, as promised, I'm going to play the rest of the interview I did with Henry Ettman. You'll hear that we're picking up in the middle. There's no introduction or explanation, as there usually is at the beginning of my interviews. Henry is talking about a dilemma that's common to a lot of people who try to make their living with some art form, and that is that you have to do more than one thing. And right before the interview begins, I'm going to play another cut from the CD he gave me. And this one is called Experiment and features not only Henry on drums, but his wife Carol on the vocals.
Before you leave these portals, to reach less fortunate mortals, there's just one final message I would give to you. We
We all have learned reliance on the sacred teachings of science. And I hope you like, you never will decline, in spite of Philistine defiance, to do what all good scientists do. Experiment. Make it your motto day and night. Experiment. And it will lead you to the light. The apple on the top of the tree is never too high to achieve. Just take an example from me. Experiment, be curious. Though interfering friends may frown, yet furious at each attempt to put you down. Give this advice you'll only employ. The future can offer you infinite joy. Experiment, experiment, and you will see. Make it your motto day and night, and it will lead you to the light. The apple on the top of the tree is never too high to achieve. Just take an example from me. Experiment, be curious. Though interfering friends may frown, get furious at each attempt to put you down. If this advice you'll only employ, the future can offer you infinite joy and merriment. Experiment, and you will see.
I've moved from academia to music. At one point, I completely left academia and became a professional musician. At other times, I've tried to do both, but it's been an interesting kind of existence, and I never was able to really reconcile the two until recent years. Interestingly, since we moved to Sarasota, where I became aware of teaching not just college, but adult education, non-credit programs. And here I started teaching courses in jazz. And I've kind of been feeling my way into a third career as a jazz educator. But that's another thing completely.
Well, no, I think it is what you're saying it is. It's the melding of the two.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah. And the playing I try to keep up with, even though there are plenty of people who are my age or older who are wonderful jazz musicians, and some are still doing very creative work. I'm always attracted to the innovators and the kind of cutting-edge stuff. And I'm not, just as a kid, I wasn't interested in pursuing traditional jazz. I'm even less interested in it now. I appreciate it, and I talk about it in my classes, and I'm fascinated by it, but it isn't what really grabs me creatively. And the community that we live in here, which is an older demographic, tends to gravitate more to that kind of music.
Yeah.
So,
well, what are you interested
what
in?
What really interests me musically is, as I say, is the cutting-edge music that's being done in jazz today, which is the jazz historians are calling postmodernist jazz, because I think the term is an apt one, because if you get into postmodernist art and postmodernist aesthetic philosophy, it's this notion of collage, really. Instead of trying to fuse things,
because we came out of fusion.
Yeah, where you had jazz rock, which was a mixture, mixing the two and coming up with something new. We're at a point in jazz where I think because of the digital revolution and because of the availability of so much music from around the world and the ability to fly around the world and to bring people from different cultures, we find that really the cutting-edge stuff that's going on in jazz, which is happening in New York and is referred to as the New York downtown scene, is made up of people who have projects where they're not trying to fuse music, but where they will have one project that is, for example, the saxophonist John Zorn has a band called Acoustic Masada, which is improvised music, but that is really klezmer music. Acoustic jazz, and uses Israeli folk themes and so on. And then he has another band.
Acoustic Masada.
Yeah,
oh my
it's
God.
A wonderful, wonderful
it's
band.
It's wonderful. Yeah. It's so
alto, saxophone, trumpet, bass, and drums. And they're the top musicians in New York. They're wonderful, wonderful players. Another fellow is a clarinet player named Don Byron, and Don Byron has all these different projects that are going at once. One is called Bug Music, which is a revival of the music of the Raymond Scott Quintet from the 1930s. Now, Raymond Scott's Quintet, the music was later adapted to Warner Brothers cartoons, and so it's called Bug Music, and that's what it sounds like. It's cartoon music. And then he has another project that is dedicated to the rhythm and blues music of Junior Walker. And then he has another, well, you see what I'm talking about.
I do.
Or instead of fusing musics, it is having different discrete projects, right, you know, that can tap into different aspects of one's creativity. And I find that fascinating. And it kind of plays into something that I'm carrying through in my teaching and is what I hope is going to be the basis of some writing I want to do. And that is that from the perspective of the musician rather than the
jazz
audience, jazz is a much more of a, how can I say, musicians are much more chameleons, the good ones, than people who adhere to a particular style and just play one kind of music and are comfortable only in one kind of music. I learned this from my years of playing music. I don't know if Carol had mentioned that we have lived for an extensive period in Reno, Nevada. I worked a lot in the casinos, in the lounges.
Playing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, in fact, I did eventually go back to graduate school for my PhD in social psychology, and I supported myself at that point by playing top 40 cover bands in lounges. And, you know, so I met a lot of people outside of really the core of the jazz world, and I found that there were people in country and western music that I had the greatest respect for, who are wonderful jazz players. I did a series of clinics for Gibson guitars in which the jazz guitarist Howard Roberts played. Mm. But he also had on those tours people like Chet Atkins, who was a wonderful jazz player, and a pedal steel guitarist from Nashville named Curly Chalker, mm-hmm, who was just a superb jazz player. And so one of the things that I'm really fascinated by is the ability of musicians to move from one art world to another with such ease. And it's expressed in this new kind of jazz that I call postmodernist, mm-hmm, kind of collage or pastiche music. And it's reflected in the fact that there is good music and bad music, and good musicians generally can move with relative ease into different styles and different forms of music.
You know, what I'm hearing is that even as a very young boy and still today, you're an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
You're on the edge. You're on the cusp. You're at the, wherever everybody else is, you're not.
Yeah, yeah. As a psychologist, you might have something
I do
to say about that.
I mean, it is kind of a theme, don't you think?
Yeah, you know, I've never really thought about it as being a continuing theme.
Well,
here I was, a kid in a private college preparatory white high school.
Rushing off to the black section of town to buy Charlie
music
Parker.
Nobody ever heard of. And and now here I am. Here we are living in Sarasota, which is a musical community, an artistic community that is more traditional. And I'm fascinated by New York, downtown, postmodernist jazz.
Well, and even, I mean, this may be stretching it, but even an interest in criminology is... I mean,
well, yeah, yeah.
You know,
they're
on the
fringe.
Yeah,
the area in sociology that I always loved teaching more than anything else was the theory course in sociology of deviant behavior. but that's where I got to talk about music and art.
Yes, but it's all the same thing,
mm-hmm,
really.
Yeah, I think so.
It's the end.
And unfortunately, the pathological side of it bleeds over into criminology.
That's correct.
Which is an area.
Right. Well, it's a continuum, right?
Mm-hmm.
And over here, you have inventive creativity and postmodern music, and over here, you've got criminal.
Yeah.
But it's the same.
Well, to a certain degree, yes, I think so.
Yes, yeah. And I'm not suggesting that you.
Well, let me just insert one other thing, as long as we're talking a little, so wide-ranging. My other academic interest in the behavioral sciences was really is developed in the area of urban planning and urban design from having taught urban sociology over many, many, many years. And this does eventually come back to music, because one of the areas that is completely fascinating to me now is in the area of, I taught actually criminology from the point of view of urban design, because crime is most prevalent in areas where there is a lack of a sense of community. And community, to a large degree, not completely, but a contributing factor of community is physical design. You can, for example, have a neighborhood that is much more neighborly,
right,
by getting rid of houses that have nothing facing the street but garages and put front porches back on them where people sit on the front porch and they meet their neighbors, something simple like that. Well, this also relates to art and music, and I started thinking about this because we moved from Reno, Nevada to Portland, Oregon, and part of the reason we moved to Portland, Oregon was because it is such a hotbed of great jazz and great kind of edgy art. Well, part of that is because it's young, but another part of it is because they have very carefully nurtured the development of the city so that energy stays focused. And you can go to downtown Portland and you can walk around and you can go to the symphony and then walk to several clubs.
You can
go to
their jazz groups.
You can hop on a free light rail or now a streetcar and go to great restaurants. Everything is within a walkable area. And it made me start thinking about the relationship of physical space to artistic development. And you start looking at, in every large municipal area, not in every one, but in a lot of them, there has been the rise and the fall of arts districts. In my home of St. Louis, we had something called Gaslight Square in the late 50s and then and through the mid-60s, which was a wonderful hotbed of artistic activity, and artistic activity that crossed borders. You had a place like the Crystal Palace, where there were comedians like Lenny Bruce working opposite jazz groups, and people like Barbara Streisand, who sang there as an undiscovered person, and the Smothers Brothers, and all these people who could then walk across the street and hear great jazz, mm-hmm, and look at great art, and the little galleries that were there, and so on. Every city you look at. You look at the transformation of things like Soho in New York, which was at one in the 70s and then into the 80s, the loft scene in New York was a hotbed of avant-garde artistic activity, and that's fallen off, and that's moved to other neighborhoods.
Brooklyn.
Part of it is, guess what, mm-hmm, real estate development and prices.
Mm-hmm.
The
right.
artists need reasonably priced areas, right, and they need walkable areas where they can physically be in touch with one another and so on. And this is something I'm not quite sure where it's going, but that I sense that there is a book in it. And I'm reading everything that's out there on this. And there's an amazing number of books about jazz in particular. The crux of my interest in the rise and fall of jazz districts in particular cities.
I'm not sure where it's going. One of the places I think it's going is I'm finding that a lot of the successful districts like Soho in New York
were made possible by a lot of manipulation by municipal government to make it affordable and to set up zoning that allows for performance and things of that sort. So if you have a district where suddenly you put up noise ordinances,
right,
that prohibit live music, obviously that's going to
put
a damper on,
right,
on this. So a lot of this is very kind of nuts and bolts common sense.
Well, but again,
no one has done it.
It's the pulling together of the various things that have been of interest to you over your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I'm still, you know, trying to figure out what I'm going to do when I grow up. And I do like to just follow these kind of pathways. You don't know where they're going, but
no,
but
I know
the journey
a lot of,
is so interesting.
In a way, it's an improvisational life.
Mm-hmm.
It is a little like jazz.
It is very much like jazz. Very,
you know,
very much,
you
yeah.
know. This is kind of interesting to me. I mean, your father was a drummer.
Mm-hmm.
He played with edgy musicians. I mean, he
played
with...
Well, in his day, yeah, in the 1920s, they were very edgy.
That's right. Yeah. So he had that. Mm-hmm. But he didn't want that for you, even though you must have gotten it from him.
Yeah. I think he was trying to protect me, because I have a... We didn't talk about it a great deal, but I have a feeling that he had felt that music had led him to some sort of substance abuse and kind of living lifestyles that were not safe. And he saw that that was still very much a part of it. When I was getting interested in modern jazz, especially African-American jazz, that was when heroin addiction was just rampant in the jazz community.
Yeah.
And, of course, today it's a completely different situation with jazz in the schools and the legitimacy of it and the cleaning up of it and so on.
Right.
So, you know, I think if I was a parent and I had a kid at the same, if I was in his place, I would have done the same thing. I would have been really frightened for my child if he'd have gone in that direction.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. Mm-hmm. And because they discouraged you, you were broadened, really, by it.
Mm-hmm.
You were able to follow other things for which you have the passion. I'm having a little trouble with this, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
Which you may not have done if you had...
Oh, no, I wouldn't have. No, I certainly wouldn't have. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's all... speculation is kind of a fool's.
Well, yeah, but this is what happened.
Yeah, this is what happened.
And there may actually be a synthesis... The book that you write, the synthesis about, you know, urban planning and jazz, which would not have existed if they'd let you become a jazz musician.
No, not at all.
So are you playing at all now?
Not now, no. I have no gigs for the rest of my life.
Wow.
I have nothing. It's an odd feeling, you know, it's an adjustment. And I can't say that it's something that I look at with relief or anything of the sort. It's with great mixture of feelings that I look at the empty calendar. I've kind of let it go because of just physical problems that I've been having that have kept me from practicing the way I want to.
Yeah.
And being kind of my creative energy being pulled more and more into teaching, which I'm now, this year I'll be teaching at 4 different institutions simultaneously.
Wow.
So that takes...
Are you teaching the same thing?
It never is the same thing exactly, because I have students who follow me, and if I teach the same class, they email me and they say, I read that you're teaching big band jazz again. Is it going to be the same material that you did before? Because I really want to take your class and I don't want to repeat it. So being the person
God.
That I am, I always say, no, it'll be different. And this is the way that I've developed this new class that I'll be teaching now for the first time in a coherent form, that I'm going to call something like Jazz Looking from the Inside Out, which is really brings together going all the way back. I did my master's thesis on this way back in 1965, and it was then, because it was in sociology, it was called Role Conflict and the Jazz Musician. And it's something that I'm really basing a class that I'm doing now upon, which is the idea that there are two things that anyone in the arts that's trying to do it as a livelihood have to deal with. And those are being pulled in the direction of the what I now call the culture industry, which is, in the case of music business. And on the other hand, doing something that is artistically valid, that you find artistically fulfilling. And how do you find the balance between the two? And as I say, I did my master's thesis on it, and that's really what this class is about. It's about doing something artistically valid today in the music business, and how does it work? And students, I did this last year, and I called it Perspectives in Jazz, which is a broad enough topic that it covers just about everything.
Whatever you'd want to teach.
Yeah, and what that class, and I taught that class 5 years ago, and students wanted to come back and take it again, and I said, well, it'll be different. Mm-hmm. And this is what forces me to kind of had these courses at least evolve, that they're, I'm not going back and teaching the same old every year. But that class, the last time, was a class in which I laid the framework for this discussion of moving around in the world of entertainment and fine art, and how do you bridge that gap, how do you deal with it. But I bring in guest musicians, and last year I had people like Dick Hyman came and did 2 hours mm-hmm. with me, and I try to get people like Dick and people who interestingly have bridged the gap. You talk to other musicians and you generally will find that the people have done all sorts of things that they're certainly not hiding this.
Yeah, right.
They're not really ashamed of it because
they
do it
do
in
it.
The spirit of craft rather mm-hmm. than art, that you can do anything and do it really, really well. And it can be very fulfilling. I just went last week to, there's a wonderful big band called the Jazz Surge, which is headquartered out of USF, and we went to one of their concerts, and the drummer with that band is a fellow named Danny Gottlieb. Danny Gottlieb is not often around this area because he's all over the place in New York and Europe, and he plays with people like the guitarist Pat Metheny mm-hmm. and is a very well-known jazz drummer internationally. And I was talking to Danny, and something came up that led him to say, oh, we're talking about St. Louis. And he said, oh, you know, I was just in that area. We were playing at Fort Leonard Wood. And I said, Fort Leonard Wood? What? He said, well, you know, my wife and I, and I didn't know his wife was also a percussionist. This might be an interesting couple for your show, by the way. He said, we have this band, and it's actually a top 40 cover band. And I said, this is a guy talking who the world knows him. He's had his picture on Modern Drummer and articles about him in Downbeat and Jazz Times. And, you know, he is known as a jazz drummer. And he plays in a top 40 band that does nothing but they play at army bases. And,
oh, my God.
And for officers' clubs. And he said, yeah, we work over 40 gigs a year, and we go out on the road. And we played this, you know, like music from the 60s and 70s, like rock band. So I've tried to bring this stuff into the classroom. And, you know, here in Sarasota, the people that take adult education are mm-hmm. really adults. They're mainly retirees. And I have found them to be fascinating because they're really interested in all this kind of edgy stuff. They don't want to hear just nostalgia about the good old days
right.
or about the swing era and so on, which I do teach, by the way, also. But they're really interested in this stuff. They love the classes on new things and the New York postmodernists and so on. But they were really fascinated last year by this material on musicians who cross borders
yes.
in music and do all of these interesting things. So I'm teaching a class for USF. I teach at the Academy for Lifelong Learning there, and I'm going to teach this class in October that will be based strictly on working in the music business.
Right. So you have crossed the borders all over the place.
Yeah, that seems to be my story.
Yeah, it does. It does. You remember you said musicians are chameleons.
Yeah. It's funny, many, many years ago, I had we still have a very, very close friend. His name is Bob Doherty. He's a wonderful bass player, and we grew up in St. Louis together. He went off to New York, and before long, he was playing with all kinds of well-known people and playing on the Tonight Show band and playing just all over the place in New York. I would talk to him occasionally, and I remember one time asking him about something I read in Downbeat, and he said, don't read that stuff. Downbeat is a dirty, rotten lie. I said, Bob, what do you mean? He said, that's, you know, they make it sound like all these people, all they're doing is creating great art. And he said, I'm here in New York, and I'm here to tell you that we do all kinds of stuff.
Right.
And you never read about
right.
in Downbeat the fact that these great, great jazz musicians are also doing backup recording on country and western
right, they're playing commercials.
And playing commercials.
Right.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And doing all this other stuff.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, no. We're not ashamed of that
right.
at all. And it's what enriches.
Right.
Enriches us.
But it really is interesting that something like Downbeat would feel like they had to pretend as though there was something to be ashamed of.
Well, I don't think that anymore that they really even try to do that. I think it's a matter of media and journalism, you know? I mean, you have so much space to fill, and you're talking really about someone's jazz work.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what comes
across
in print.
So that's what they talk about.
That's what they talk about.
Right.
And you know, people draw their own conclusions. And I try in my teaching, in my classes, to kind of debunk that.
Right, to expand.
Yeah, right? Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, and it's, you know, when you, to me, it's, that's the fascinating thing, is when you get past
the stereotype.
What the person is doing, that is the stereotype impression of what they're doing.
Also, I think, you know, you haven't actually said it, but one needs to make a living.
Yeah.
And,
exactly.
So one cannot always make a living chasing art.
Well, I think Carol and I are both good examples of that, because we're both people who have had other careers. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, my quote unquote real career was as an academic sociologist. I mean, my PhD is in social psychology.
Yeah, but when you say your real career, you mean the thing that garnered you the most income?
Yeah.
Yeah, because yeah. I don't think, anyway, from what you've been saying, I don't know that that's your real career.
No. not really.
No. When you talk about music, when you talk about jazz, mm-hmm. clearly the passion is there.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's hard to be an artist in this culture. I think we are not a culture that really supports art, and not mm-hmm. music, not fine art, not dance, not, we just don't. And when you were talking about, you know, your father discouraging you before, you mm-hmm. explained about his concern that you might fall in with stuff that would damage you.
Yes.
A lot of parents discourage their kids from music or dance or art, not because they're afraid they'll become drug addicts, but because they think it's not a legitimate life, or because they think they won't make a living, or because, you know.
Yeah, I think that fortunately that's changing somewhat, because to reveal my age, I mean, I was growing up in the late 40s and the 1950s, and in those days it was a very, very different kind of situation. There wasn't, in music, for example, things like jazz studies programs. Mm-hmm. It didn't have the
legitimacy.
It didn't have the legitimacy. You
know. Yeah, but it's still tough to make a living.
Oh yeah.
You know, that hasn't changed. Mm. And you can go to a jazz studies program, but that doesn't guarantee that you're going to be able to make a living playing jazz. Well, this has been unexpected and lovely. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anything else that I haven't asked you that you might like to say?
Mm. Boy, I think we've pretty well covered.
I do too.
Great. Thank
okay,
you.
So let's go talk to Carol.
Okay.
And so we did. We went off not only to talk to Carol, but to have dinner. And now, as promised, I'm going to play another cut from the CD that Henry gave me. This one is an instrumental. It's Where or When. And on piano is Mike Markovarich, who you will really appreciate, and who I'm happy to say I'm going to be interviewing soon. And so you'll hear an interview with Mike. He's a remarkable person and talent. So here now is Henry Ettman on drums and Mike Markovarich on piano playing Where or When.
Thank you.
Isn't that terrific? Not only is that the wonderful work of Henry Ettman, but the piano is being played by Mike Markovarich, who's you heard. And I interviewed Mike actually yesterday, and we'll be airing that interview in September when I hope to do 4 shows on piano players. A particular soft spot for me, the piano, and those people who play it. So as usually the case these days, I'm running right out of time. This is very funny to me because when I first started doing these shows, I couldn't fill up the time. And now I'm always running out. I suppose that's the good news. Anyway, thank you for listening. I hope that you heard something that you can use, or something that you enjoyed, or something that enhanced your life, something that makes you want to come back again. And again, as always, I have to thank Josh Hackney, the person really without whom this show could not go on. It could go on without me, and it could go on without the people I interview, but Josh, who does all of the technical stuff and makes sure that the sound is as good as it can be, given the limits of my equipment. There's just no way to overemphasize the importance of Josh. And as always, if you go up on my website and click on Contact Me, I will find him for you if you need him. So, again, this is The Lynn Show, and I will be here same time, same station next week. And boy, I hope you will be too.
See, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. See that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle.
Tune in again next week when I'll continue to explain how our unconscious mind operates in our life and how it protects us from doing things we might think we want to do but really are not yet ready to do. And for the first half of an interview with Judy Lyon Schneider, an artist who works in every conceivable media that there is.
But I still got some tang, so you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten